You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, August 19th, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Hari Hahn, co-author of Prisms of the People, Power and Organizing in 21st Century America. Meanwhile, Afghan protests in Kabul and other cities against the Taliban rage for the second day in a row, with at least two deaths reported a day after at least three protesters were reportedly killed. Biden has now said that some U.S. troops will remain in Afghanistan until every American is evacuated, even if that extends beyond his August 31st deadline. The Intercept is also reporting that the Taliban have seized U.S. military biometrics devices containing eye scans and fingerprints, which could help ID U.S. collaborators. More of our weapons and arms in the hands of the Mujahideen. How poetic. Haiti's earthquake death toll balloons to over 2,100, destroying thousands of homes and churches, leaving over 30,000 families homeless as a tropical storm lashes the nation. The Biden administration has greenlit a third COVID vaccine booster shot starting in December, much to the disapproval of world health officials who decried the decision as indefensible in light of the enormous global vaccine gap. Biden also announced that all nursing homes must require their staff to be vaccinated or lose federal Medicare and Medicaid funding, as his administration begins to threaten legal action against states barring masks in schools. And lastly, a federal judge has blocked construction permits for a giant oil drilling project in Alaska, one that the Biden administration, despite its flowery language on climate change, has chosen to support. All this and more on today's program. Welcome back to the show, ladies and gentlemen, or welcome to the show if this is the first time that you are seeing this beautiful program. I am not Sam Steeder. Sam will be out for the next, I guess, including today, Friday, and all of next week. He is on a much-needed vacation. I'd never say that to his face, obviously, but yeah, he does deserve it. He works hard. And so I hope you stick with us. I think we have a lot of great interviews lined up, a lot of great guests, including today.
A few changes to do also. A few changes kind of come down the pipe.
What do you mean?
Well, we'll get to those later. We don't want to do shock and awe.
I don't even remember. I presumably know what you're talking about, but I don't remember what you're talking about. So, I guess we will talk about that later. But let's talk a little bit more about Afghanistan. Obviously, it's the first and biggest story in the news right now. So, there's been a bit of a scramble by members of the intelligence community to point fingers at other people, namely the Biden administration, for the chaos that has ensued and the bloodshed following our withdrawal from Afghanistan, the swift rise to power by the Taliban. And all of this finger pointing, which is taking place in the press, it leads back to the inevitable conclusion from these intelligence community people that we should be in Afghanistan longer, right? That's what they desire. And so what they're leaking to the media is all designed to bolster that very case.
They meaning particularly the CIA.
The CIA.
We knew this was going to happen, and we had, look at this file we found that can prove it. Look at, don't look at us for, you know, this complete failure, which is, of course, in large part due to CIA and military intelligence.
Right. And the fact that intelligence is often contradictory, and they can pull out that one file that totally rips into the Biden administration, wow, we knew this would happen. How could you do this? And then they have a million other files that would be more favorable. They strategically leak this stuff in order to maintain U.S. imperialism in the case for war. Legacy media is reprinting these cover your beep CYA efforts as if they're fact, which we know they tend to do, and they lean on intelligence sources that are cherry picking this intel so that they can back up their own desire to remain occupying Afghanistan. So Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, who recently went viral for his response on a question by Matt Gaetz to about the military learning about critical race theory, which was pretty good. He chose to respond to some of those claims yesterday.
Let me make one comment on the intelligence, because I'm seeing all over the news that there are warnings of a rapid collapse. I have previously said from this podium and in sworn testimony before Congress that the intelligence clearly indicated multiple scenarios were possible. One of those was an outright Taliban takeover following a rapid collapse of the Afghan security forces and the government. Another was a civil war, and a third was a negotiated settlement. However, the time frame of a rapid collapse, that was widely estimated and ranged from weeks to months and even years following our departure. There was nothing that I or anyone else saw that indicated a collapse of this army and this government in 11 days.
So I actually do believe him. I think part of the reason that presidents didn't make this call, and we've covered this extensively on the show, to withdraw from Afghanistan was because of what they perceived as a mountain of blowback from the media, which we're seeing now, and the intelligence community that was always going to do this because they work backwards from their desire to remain in the region. That's just how they operate. And Biden made the correct decision here, and it's deeply sad that the Taliban's taken over. But, you know, I actually believe Milley there. And it's not because I trust government officials or the Biden administration inherently. It's because I inherently, for good reason, mistrust our intelligence community.
Well, yeah, there's a structural problem with military intelligence, which, I mean, is evident in the Mike Hastings book on and reporting on Standing in the Crystal, which is there's a whole bunch of things stopping the worst news from getting to the top, and the denial of basic reality is baked into these intelligence assessments. So I think it's probably true, but I think that points to a, you know, like you said, a larger failure in our ability to confront reality when we're, you know, killing lots of people with our war machine.
Right. And I think we also can make the point that we recognize, based on past experience and reporting from people like Michael Hastings and just understanding of what the war on terror was like, that we've seen what's happening in the press right now before. It's exactly what has happened for decades when it comes to our involvement in the Middle East and abroad, and we, I don't think, sufficiently critique the national security reporters that breathlessly reprint right. This stuff.
Well, this is beyond media critique. This is critique of the CIA and the military, who co-opt media as if they are taking a military objective. That's just like part of their job, and it's completely hostile to democracy, and it always really has been, especially on the part of the CIA.
And the media critique can be shallow and but in this instance, it's because they're operative in this project that it's important to understand. And, you know, the other thing about this, too, is that the intelligence community is inflating their importance. We didn't need intel to know that the pullout from Afghanistan was going to be messy. We were talking about it on this program, too. And, you know, I guess, perhaps it can have some value, but they believe that they are instrumental to
the whole problem with Afghanistan is, like, people like the CIA and, of course, like, Soviets have been empowering warlords in that country for decades and decades and decades. And that's not a good way to, for instance, see an improvement in the, for the lot of women in any kind of country.
And that was what they were doing in Afghanistan for decades at this point. That was a part of, like, the American-backed financed government that they were upholding there. And so, like, they have self-interest. These are their jobs. They want to see some of this stuff through. It's also human, but the human element is propping up something that's psychopathic.
Yeah, and I just think, like, Jim Sciutto of CNN NatSec reporter tweeted this out yesterday. "Too many times I've witnessed the U.S. military attempt to dutifully carry out difficult and dangerous missions left to them by the miscalculations of civilian leaders." That is really dangerous talk. Like, I think that that politicians deserve a whole bunch of blame for their failures and participation in just mass atrocity. But the idea that they're the obstacle and not our military, who's been out of control for, I mean, definitely post World War II, and then, you know, you want to go into, you know, 20th century, 19th century history, or 19th century history, like, you know, it's a bad thing.
Yeah, it should not be a part of modern society that we're deferring to the wise leadership of military officials over elected officials and saying that that's what gets in the way. Like
literal professional assassins. That's who we're prioritizing over civilian leadership.
Right. And that's, like, a scary assumption that underlies a lot of the fall of major democracies and governments throughout the world. When you give credence to military leadership, and I know that seems ironic given the fact that we just played a clip from Millie there, but, you know, the context is everything.
Right, exactly. The context of Millie saying that. That's another kind of dangerous thing Millie does, is he blames the press there. Say the CIA, Millie. Like, that's who's actually mm-hmm. leaking that stuff to the press.
Well, yes. We have a problem with naming our intelligence community, the CIA, the FBI, in their role in some of these in some of these outcomes. And a lot of that is because there's a fetishization of what they do, when I think a lot of our viewers understand the reality of what they do and how much destruction that they have caused throughout the globe and domestically as well. We are going to take a quick break, very quick break. And when we come back, we will be joined by Hari Han, the author of, or co-author of, I should say, Prisms of the People, Power, and Organizing in 21st Century America. All right, we are back, and I would like to welcome to the show Hari Han. She is the co-author of Prisms of the People, Power, and Organizing in the 21st Century, in 21st Century America. Hari, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, so I'm excited to talk to you about this. You write about grassroots organizing and collective action, which I think is something that our audience in particular is interested in, because I saw a lot of what your book did was kind of as a critique of, in many ways, electoralism, or the reliance on elites to enter the reliance on entering into those spheres as opposed to creating your own power systems to combat elites, which are arguments that I'm incredibly in favor of and sympathetic to. So I guess let's just start really from the beginning. What drove you to write about grassroots organizing and collective action?
Yeah, so I, the book Prisons of the People is probably, it's you know, I've written several books about grassroots organizing. And I think I really got into it because I grew up as a daughter of Korean immigrants in Texas. And so my family was super apolitical growing up. We lived in this very kind of diverse immigrant, working class, immigrant community. And so politics was not at all something that I thought about. But what really got me interested in it was when I went to college and got involved in student activism, and through happenstance, kind of had this experience of working with a bunch of other people to realize what we could do if we worked together, which is so much better than just working alone. And I think that's what got me really hooked in organizing and politics. And so I went and I worked in capital P politics in Washington, D.C. for a few years, but then eventually realized that when I was like working in the day-to-day of a political campaign, for example, I couldn't really think about what was going on and decided to go back to grad school. And that's when I thought, well, I really want to do is like study and understand organizing and collective action and how it works.
So, I mean, what was that experience like for you to work on campaigns? Because I did, you know, I think a small amount of just grunt internship work back in my younger days on campaigns. And it sucked. Like, I mean, I totally respect and understand like why people work on campaigns, and that's instrumental. But I just mean in terms of like, okay, this is the one singular goal, and it's the election. It doesn't, I guess, have larger implications. I kind of quickly understood that maybe that wasn't for me, but it seems like you had a bit of that same reckoning.
Yeah. Well, so actually, I'll tell you two stories. So the first campaign I actually ever worked on was George Bush Sr. in 1992, not because I knew anything about politics or thought that I was Republican, because I was in Texas and I was taking a history class and they required us to go like volunteer for a campaign. And that was like the easiest one to go and sign up for. So that was the first time where I was like, I really had no idea what was happening. So I show up on a Saturday morning and they give me like a list of doors or whatever. They assigned me to someone and we had like a clipboard with a list of doors and we're supposed to go and knock on all these doors. And we, you know, did our thing. We come back after like several hours and it's super hot. And we give the clipboard to the volunteer coordinator, whoever. And I remember he looked at the clipboard and was like, great, thanks. And then like threw it into a pile with a bunch of other clipboards. And the first thing I realized was like I'm just a cog in this giant machine. Like they don't actually care at all about this experience that that we had. And so that just kind of drove me, I think, even further to politics and took me a while to get back to it. But when I, then in 2000, I worked on Democratic presidential campaigns and had a much better experience. Like on that, in that sense, I was working as staff and, you know, really remember that experience that I had in high school and tried to always think about like, how are we cultivating these experiences for volunteers who are coming and trying to actually be a part of the bigger campaign. But, so I think we did that, but I will admit, I think like you, like it always felt like an uphill battle, you know, because the world of politics is super transactional and it's really hard to feel like you're actually doing something valuable and that you're actually part of something bigger. And I think that's what drove me to want to get more involved with more kind of movement work or grassroots organizing work when I went back to grad school.
Can there be campaigns that are a bit more, you know, movement adjacent or sympathetic to that? I mean, of course, the Bernie Sanders campaign on a national scale comes to mind, but progressive candidates that are fundraising from small donations that I never was able to work on that kind of campaign, but I covered them. That has shades of a lot of what you talked about in your book, I would imagine.
Yeah. To me, the big question is, what is the campaign leaving behind? You know, so a typical campaign, it's like you burn all through all these resources, including human resources, right? Including people, both staff and volunteers. And then come election day, win or lose, everyone's out of there, right? And there's nothing left in the community.
Yeah.
And to me, a campaign that is working in movement adjacent ways, like the Sanders campaign, I think portions of the 2008 Obama campaign, like I think there, you know, we have examples in modern history, are ones where, you know, when the campaign ends, regardless of victory or loss of that particular campaign, there's something left in the community. community that lasts beyond the candidate and beyond the campaign themselves. And to me, that's the mark of a movement that makes it different from the transactional political world that dominates elections.
Well, I mean, now I have so many examples, right, to contrast. So say, take the Kentucky Senate race against Mitch McConnell, right? Mm-hmm. Charles Booker was a grassroots candidate, and he got close, but he didn't win the primary against mm-hmm. Amy McGrath, who lost in very convincing fashion to Mitch McConnell in the general election. That was such a missed opportunity, in my view, even though Booker is running again against Rand Paul, to make something that lasted in a campaign, as opposed to something where a ton of money flowed in from Chuck Schumer's fundraising apparatus. And like the emptiness of that, I could feel it from here in New York. Like that was just such a stark example of the dynamic you're talking about.
I 100% agree. And I'll give you another example that broke my heart personally, because it was in Texas, was Beto O'Rourke's campaign. Mm. You know, when he ran for Senate, came really close to defeating Ted Cruz, had generated so much grassroots energy across the state. And if they had been able to harness that to rebuild the capital D Democratic Party politics in the state, then, you know, that would have potentially had much bigger ramifications, right? If Texas turns blue, that has much bigger ramifications for our politics.
Well, we saw it succeed in Georgia. We saw this exact dynamic. I mean, Stacey Abrams' campaign set up the infrastructure for what we saw today.
Exactly. Yeah, because she had lost, right? Like, people forget that, but she had lost her, or I mean, well, we can debate whether or not she lost, but she, regardless of whether or not who got the most votes, she was not seated as governor, let's say. Yes. But she took that infrastructure and she turned it into something so much bigger that has had these huge impacts in our national politics. And imagine if Beto had done the same, you know, with his losing Senate campaign.
Yes, we'll never know. He ran for president instead, and we all saw how that work turned out.
Right.
But I guess, like, you know, because your book is more focused on organizing outside of elections, we can, you know, talk less about some of those elections. You open your book using the example of Arizona SB 1070, kind of a lens to which through which you're looking at this. What struck you in particular about that fight?
Yeah, so the book kind of starts with this question of why is it that we've seen this trend, especially in 21st century America, where so many people can pour into the streets, get involved in politics in a lot of different ways, and government seems not to respond, right? And we have examples, you know, again and again and again of where that happens. And so what we wanted to do is sort of figure out, where are there outliers? Where are there places that have actually broken through and beat that trend, where people who take action actually do have influence in changing the outcomes that they want? And the reason why we were interested in Arizona was because over the decade between 2010 to 2020, roughly, when we were doing the research, a lot of the immigrant rights groups that had emerged from the fight around the pushback to SB 1070 that happened in 2010, they were able to kind of change the politics of Arizona. And we finished writing our book before the 2020 election happened. But I think, you know, in the same way that we were just talking about Georgia, a lot of the work that they did laid the groundwork for flipping Arizona in 2020. But part of what we wanted to understand was what was the work that they were doing during that decade when no one was really paying attention at a national level to the work that was going on the ground. And so we started in this moment in 2010 when, you know, SB 1070 was the most restrictive immigration law that had been passed up until that point. And it came as a little bit of a surprise, right? It wasn't that immigration issues hadn't been hotly debated for many years, but no one really thought that you could have a law quite that restrictive. And so it flew through the Arizona state legislature, and we profiled these two organizers who were like, oh my God, you know, what just happened? What do we do? You know, and that question of like, what do we do in this moment could have gone in so many directions. And that was what we wanted to try to really unpack.
So, I mean, then talk about the fight, I guess, in particular, too, because you also talk about the flip side of what happened in Arizona with Proposition 206. I guess you can talk about both of those examples and how they were instructive.
Yeah. So in 2010, after SB 1070, you know, there's this moment where everyone is just thinking like, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? And if you think about, like, if we were to just think about the transactional political world, that electoral world that we were just thinking about, like, what would people say, right? They might say things like, well, we're trying to get then Governor Dan Brewer to not sign this bill. So let's
And
let's
for start- people that don't know, what was the bill?
The bill, so this is the Show Me Your Papers law, which is a really restrictive anti-immigration law that, you know, essentially authorized, you know, local governments to, you know, violate the rights of immigrant communities all over the state. And so, you know, the instinct for a lot of cases could have been like, okay, let's start a petition. We'll get like, you know, millions of people from across America to sign these petitions to try to get Jan Brewer to not sign the law, right? We're going to try to raise all this money and have these big call campaigns to the governor's office or the state legislatures or different things like that. We're going to boycott Arizona businesses, right? These are the kind of strategies that people fall back on. And I think, you know, what these organizers did, which is so interesting, is they said, you know what, like what we want to do is we want them to see our faces, right? Like they wanted to humanize that fight. And so what they ended up deciding to do was essentially organize a vigil on the state house lawn that started out as 4 people and grew to like hundreds of people. And it didn't have the scale of a petition campaign or something like that. But what ended up happening is that they sustained that vigil for over 100 days. And that vigil became this crucible of leadership development and relationship building that then lay the foundation for the decade-long fight that came afterwards, right? So I think it's conceivable that we could say that Arizona 2020 wouldn't have happened if that vigil hadn't happened, if they hadn't spent 3 months, you know, there. And an example of the kind of work that went on there is there's this great story of when Sheriff Arpaio, who's a notorious, very strongly anti-immigrant sheriff in Arizona. So this is when he was still in office, and he came at some point out to the vigil, and he was going to try to, you know, get them to leave the lawn and, you know, exert his authority in different ways. And there was a group of Latino women who were in a prayer circle at the time, and he comes and starts trying to push them away. And this woman turns around and she walks up to him and she puts her hand up in his face and says, respect, like we're praying right now, you know? And so it's just a sort of small story of the way in which people who are at their most vulnerable were able to realize their own ability to stand up to power. And then that, you know, that vigil didn't achieve its short-term victory in the sense that SB 1070 did pass, but that laid the groundwork for all the work that came thereafter. And like, that was part of the, you know, in the similar to what we were talking about before, is that win or lose, what does the campaign leave behind? Well, that vigil left a ton of things behind in a way that would have been really different had they just done a petition campaign or something like that.
Well, I mean, you've talked about petition campaigns or boycotting campaigns, right? Like, a lot of that to me seems more passive. And I think boycotts can actually, I mean, of course, I'm a supporter of BDS, for example. They can have enormous power. But say, like, a national saying, oh, we're, you know, what we're seeing a little, what we saw a little bit in Georgia over the voting rights bill, the restriction. Like, I don't know what that does. I think it allows people to feel like they're participating in activism without doing so. Like, genuinely. It's kind of just like what some of the philanthropy, like the donations that you're seeing, I don't want to be too cynical, but in some humanitarian efforts, like, are you as cynical as me about that kind of stuff? Because I worry about its sapping of energy of longer term, more effective projects.
Yeah, so I am cynical, but I think of it a little bit as a both and. And and here's the analogy that I have. So I have a 10-year-old who's really into survival skills right now. And so we spend a lot of time like thinking about how you build fires, right? And so one of the things that you learn if you're trying to build fires is that if you like go out and try to, you know, light a match on all these big logs, like your fire is going to die, right? Like instead, what you have to do is you light the match on the tinder, which heats up the kindling, and the kindling heats up the fuel logs, and that fuel logs are what sustain the fire over time. And to me, the kind of things like a large-scale petition, a big boycott, things like that, those are the fuel logs. And the mistake that we make is not in trying to do those, because if you need that kind of scale, you need to give lots of people opportunities to support you and get involved. But it's trying to sort of light the fuel log without having the tinder and the kindling already there, you know. And so if I'm an organizer and I'm lighting that match, the match that I should be lighting is on the people who are going to be the transformative leaders, right, that really invest in and build this fire, so to speak, right? And then if they're strategically chosen, then you know, they in their own social networks will then begin to heat up the proverbial fuel log, or kind of like start that petition or whatever it is. And I think too often what we see is that you see a lot of campaigns that go straight to the petition and they have nothing underlying it. So the moment they get challenged or the moment something goes wrong, they have nothing to fall back on. The spark disappears.
Right. And then I guess you talk about this Proposition 206 fight in Arizona as an outlier, essentially, which is a good way to look at activism, because there was a success here. And a lot of times it's not gonna be successful, which I think is really important for people to understand how to be an effective organizer and activist.
Yeah, I mean, the null expectation whenever you start any kind of social change effort is definitely status quo, you know? And that's not just true for grassroots organizing. That's true if I was like starting a lobbying campaign to try to overturn X law or something like that. Like, change is just really hard given the way that our system is structured. So status quo is absolutely the null expectation. But I have an organizer friend who has a saying, you know, which is that organizing is like beating your head against a wall until it's not, right? Like, it's this kind of thing where it's like you feel like you're making no progress. Then all of a sudden, it's like the floodgates open. And I think often we see that in campaigns like this, where, because there's, you know, you lay the groundwork, you know, the progress is really hard to make visible, but then all of a sudden something happens and everything kind of explodes, you know. And I think when we think about Arizona in 2020, for example, just to go back to that example, it's like, you know, no one in 2010, when they were having that vigil on the State House lawn, could have anticipated that 10 years from now, you know, all the whole country's eyes would be on them and thinking about which direction they're going to go in this very contested presidential election. Like, no one could have predicted that. But were they ready when the moment came? Absolutely, right? And that's because of all that work that they had done before. And so, you know, in Prop 206, the story that we tell there, you know, that was an effort to try to get minimum wage passed in Arizona through a statewide ballot initiative. And the organization that we were studying, which is an immigrant rights organization called Lucha, when they first started trying to work on this, everyone was like, don't do it. Like, Arizona is not ready. Like, we're seeing minimum wage go through in cities like Seattle and these different kind of blue cities and blue states, but Arizona's not ready. Like, stick to your lane, work on immigration issues. And, you know, the leaders of Lucha were like, look, you know, I know we hear what you're saying, but our people are saying what they need is they need better wages. I mean, that's what their communities were telling them. And so they persisted. And the fight that they had to have was that, you know, when finally they were able to kind of bring people around actually running the campaign. And by people, I mean kind of the national democratic establishment. When they were able to bring them around, then the people were like, fine, if you're going to run this, you know, minimum wage campaign in Arizona, we're going to bring in this like consultant from DC and he's going to come in, he's going to teach you how to run the campaign. So just step aside. And they were like, no, like, we want to do this on our own terms, you know, and they had to fight to earn that right. But then they did. And they ran the campaign in a way that was trying to leave something behind, right? That was trying to build real capacity in these communities that could be used beyond the campaign. And they worked really strategically to try to build alliances with local business to kind of bridge across differences that you would normally think of as being in opposition to each other. They were able to win that campaign, and, you know, the whole infrastructure they had built in that campaign then went on to support all this other work they've been doing in the state.
Right. And I mean, you mentioned consultants. That's a...
I have a lot of feelings about consultants.
Well, then, I mean, I'm going to ask you to elaborate a bit, because I think, you know, a lot of people don't understand how much of a cottage industry the consultant practice is in. I mean, they basically almost bankrupted the DNC because they were so committed to this group of moneyed consultants who don't add anything, provide the perception that they're very busy and they're adding something. So I guess, talk a little bit about that as an antithesis to the kind of organizing you're talking about here.
Yeah, so there's a study by some political scientists, which is not my work, by Jacob Montgomery at Washington University and Brendan Nyhan, where they were looking at what is the impact of consultants on political campaigns, essentially, right? And if I were to kind of like talk to you and say like, well, what do you think are the things that determine campaign strategy, right? And here we're talking about congressional campaigns. So this is like House and Senate campaigns. And you might say things like, well, is there an incumbent in office? Is it a red state? Is it a blue state? Is it a swing state? You know, I mean, things that we can kind of anticipate as being the typical things that we would think of as determining campaign strategy. And what they found was that when they looked at a bunch of, I think it was House and Senate elections, and they tracked what the sort of variation in strategy was, the single most predictive factor of what kind of strategy your campaign used was not whether you were in a red state or blue state, whether you were having, it was incumbent or an open seat or, you know, any of these other factors that we might think about. It was which consultant you hired, right? Which is crazy. Like, it kind of blows my mind, right? Because what it means is that these consultants kind of have these formulas that they go, and whether they're working in a red state or like, no matter where they're working,
one size fits all, right?
It's a one size fits all kind of thing. But then these, you know, if you're a candidate and let's say you're an insurgent candidate and you're saying, I want to try to run a different kind of campaign, then the first thing that you hear, and this is kind of what happened in Prop 206, is everyone says, you can't do it. You know, you can't do it alone. You can't do it your way. You need to hire these people that have experience. And they come in and they have a formula, you know, and they teach you how to do it. And I think that there's a real kind of chokehold almost on the way that a lot of politics are run because of that consulting industry. Now, I should just qualify. It's not to say there aren't some great consultants out there. There are, who do amazing work, but it's really hard, I think, for new people to break into that world and be able to differentiate between who's selling me a bag of goods and who's doing really good strategic work here.
Yeah, and I think part of that is a sapping of the agency of people, right? Where they kind of make you feel like there are so many barriers to entry. And of course you don't understand how to do this campaign, silly person, right? And often that's very gendered and racialized as well. Like, there's a ton of disincentives and a lack of encouragement when talking about these grassroots campaigns, because there's this understanding from a lot of people in politics that you can only do it if you have this knowledge base. And so it causes people to make pretty bad decisions when oftentimes, especially progressive candidates, have a fairly good understanding of what their community is yearning for.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. There was a study that was done by, I can't remember exactly what year, but it was within the last decade, an organization that looked at the racial background of consultants hired by the Democratic Party and Democratic Party candidates. And it was something like over 95% white. You know, and so there's a mismatch between the people who are doing the consulting and both the candidates and the communities on the ground that they're seeking to reach out to. And it creates all the distortions that that you can imagine. I think the other thing is, you know, thinking about the book that we were working on, like one of the things that we wanted to really understand is this question of, you know, how did, in this moment of like disaffection, when everyone hates politics, right? How was it that these organizations were able to help people feel like they could be architects of their own future? And that's like the opposite of what the consultant does, right? Where they kind of come in and say, you can't design your campaign and you can't design your future. Like, you need to leave it to us. And I think too often people have the sense that like, oh, politics is for the professionals. Like, you know, I can't actually have some say in what goes on in my community. And that was the opposite of what we found in these organizations.
So, and then also, I guess you talk about another example from Virginia with the new Virginia majority. That was another really interesting case. Explain that to our audience, if you could.
Yeah. So, Virginia for a long time had some of the most restrictive voting rights laws for returning citizens in the country. And so I think they were ranked like somewhere down at the, you know, 49th or 50th, like with Kentucky in terms of how restrictive they were. And for a long time, there had been a coalition of organizations, New Virginia Majority, which is the one that we profile, but also the Virginia Organizing Project and other organizations in the state that had been working for a long time to try to restore voting rights to returning citizens. Because what was happening is that because Black and Latino communities are so disproportionately incarcerated, that meant they were effectively left out of the electorate as well, because they weren't able to renew their citizenship once they came out of office. And so they have worked with both Republican and Democratic governors for many years. Like, this had gone on for a bunch of years. And it finally, it was during the McAuliffe administration when the governor essentially has this right to effectively issue these pardons that would open up voting rights to all these returning citizens. And he issued like hundreds of them, you know, in a way that that enabled basically a big portion of the Black and Brown community to start to vote again. But what was really interesting about that was that, you know, we were trying to figure out, like, well, how did this happen? You know, how was it that it, because if you look at public opinion in the state, support for voting rights had not shifted, you know, and the political calculus for governors like Terry McAuliffe hadn't really shifted either. And so why was it that they were suddenly able to make this big shift? And so much of it had to do with the work that groups like New Virginia Majority, Virginia Organizing Project had done to kind of build constituencies in communities among people who were willing to kind of come to the state house and really hold elected officials' feet to the fire, right? And also have the back of elected officials when they went out on a limb and kind of took a risk on different things. And one of the really interesting things that we found was that one of the kind of key leaders in New Virginia Majority is a woman named Tran Nguyen, who's like really talented organizer. And, you know, I remember, you know, we spent a day kind of shadowing her in the Virginia State House, and she's had these incredible relationships with these elected officials throughout. And I think that was one of the things that we really learned that was interesting, is that unlike these big kind of newsworthy protests and rallies, like, so much of this work in terms of shifting the political power in favor of these organizations happened through this kind of negotiation. But that negotiation had to be grounded in the work they had done in the community.
What do you do, though, when they won't even take your calls? Like, I mean, there was a report that came out of Arizona, to bring it back, about how Kristen Sinema just doesn't even take calls from organizers on the left, immigrant rights, for example, groups in Arizona. Like, how do you move the unmovable?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, in organizing, there's this kind of like this idea of like the difference between sort of building power with versus building power over. And so, you know, in a lot of cases, what you can do is you can build power with an elected official, right? Like, you have shared interests, right? They want votes and they want support. You've got a constituency that you've organized. And so you can kind of trade your resources to act on each other's interests. And so they support the agenda that you're trying to advance. And then you help support them with votes and other kinds of things that they might need. And that's an example of building power with. But in some situations, like the one that you're describing with Sinema, it's really a situation where you have to exert power over, right? And so the question is, if I'm working with an elected official who won't take my calls, who's essentially blocking me, then the question is, what are the resources and the sources of power that I have that can essentially try to force someone like Sinema to pay attention, you know? And I think obviously in Arizona, like, that situation is very fluid. And then with the kind of polarized politics that we have, it's really hard to kind of figure out how to break through. But I think one of the things that we were really struck by is that in all the organizations that we studied, you know, these organizations were working, you know, across partisan lines, across kind of like business and not, you know, low-income communities, like all these kind of differences that we would normally think of as being opposites. And they built these coalitions in order to be able to negotiate for power in the ways that you're describing.
Yeah, I really like that focus in your book on focusing on creating independent power centers. And I mentioned this earlier, but outside of gatekeepers like herself, or even within the K Street, Washington traditional lobby, building a power center that is in Oklahoma, that is in Texas, that is in, you know, Montana, whatever the case may be. That is, I think, instrumental, but it's harder and it takes a while. I'm just wondering if you could talk a bit more about having a long-term strategy within short-term goals, because I think in the wake of Bernie Sanders' campaign failing in 2020, there's been a lot of misplaced energy in some ways and not really a fully formed understanding of the long, hard work of change and progress. It's not linear. There's huge setbacks, and then there's largely incremental gains, and then the occasional huge gain, but that's pretty rare. I'm just wondering what your take is on how to incentivize that marathon mentality.
Right. So a couple things. So maybe I'll just like start with a historical story, and then kind of start, and then I think it'll link back to your question. So there's this woman named Frances Willard, who at the turn of the 20th century, she was like a real warrior for against domestic violence. Like, she was really concerned about domestic violence. This is like the late 1800s. And at the time, she was trying to look around and figure out, like, what can we do to stop domestic violence? And she figured out, like, well, the big problem is what happens is that men go out to bars and they get drunk and they come home and they beat their wives. And so her solution was, if I want to stop domestic violence, what I need to do is ban alcohol. Okay, which I am not advocating, by the way. So she starts this campaign to ban alcohol, which eventually succeeds in passing the constitutional amendment that banned alcohol for a period of time in the early 20th century, right? And so the question is, like, how do you go about like passing a constitutional amendment? Because it's actually really, really hard, right? You have to get 3/4 of the states to sign on. You have to get super majorities in state legislatures and in the National Congress, like all this kind of stuff. And so the way that she did it was, she went all over the country and she would try to recruit people to her cause, you know? And the first thing that she did was she would say, if you want to join my cause, the first thing you have to do is like take a personal pledge to sign off alcohol, right? To sort of, you know, show us that your values are aligned. But then the second thing you need to do is you need to get together with a group of people in your community and try to shut down a bar, right? And it doesn't matter if you win or lose, we just want you to try, right? And if you know anything about how a constitutional amendment is passed, whether or not Joe's bar is open in any town USA is completely irrelevant to whether or not that constitutional amendment gets passed, right? But the reason she was doing that is she wanted people to have the experience of collective action, right?
Well, sorry not to interrupt, but not just people, but women who had not been given the right to vote at this point and who were finding agency in the suffrage movement.
Totally. So women who were not used to having their hands in the levers of change, she was showing them that they could like work with other people, right, and learn something. And so it didn't really matter whether or not you were successful. It was more that you had that experience. And then once you did that, she would invite you to join the national movement, right? And it became this kind of like big thing. And of course, as soon as they passed the constitutional amendment, they realized that we actually really do like our alcohol, and they passed it back the other way. But to me, the bigger point of the story is this question of, you know, when you ask that question of, well, how do you do work in the short term that builds capacity for the long term? Like, the question that I like to ask organizers is, what is your Joe's bar? You know, what is that thing where you're giving people this experience of putting their hands in levers of change, of learning that if they work with each other, they can do more than they can by themselves? Because that's always going to be with them, win or lose, right? And so it took decades to pass this constitutional amendment, but they had built this continual capacity over time. And I think that we see that trend again and again and again, is that the most successful social movements throughout history always have some form of that Joe's bar. You know, it can be in a church, it can be in a gun club, it can be, you know, in an immigrant community fighting to protect families from deportation, right? I mean, it can be around police shootings. I mean, there's like so many sort of settings in which that kind of experience can happen, but it's that experience of working together that really matters. And so the question of like how you incentivize it, I mean, so to me, like, that's part of what we were trying to do in the book, is like, I think that if people think that the way that you make change is by getting these mass petitions without having that, you know, without having that base of that, the people from the Joe's bar, the people who are, I'm like mixing all my metaphors now, but the Tinder, or the Kindling, or whatever it is that you want to say, then you're not incentivized to do that work of getting people to actually, you know, figure out how they shut down that bar in their community. But if you understand that that's actually how you're going to get to the goal that you want, then I think the incentives become a lot clearer.
I agree. Well, Hari Han, her book is called Prisms of the People, Power and Organizing in 21st Century America. That was great talking to you. And I hope, you know, people who are politically inclined, I would imagine you are if you're watching this show, you might be able to glean some lessons from some of the advice that Hari provided today. Thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking a bit more about the Afghanistan withdrawal. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the Afghanistan withdrawal. So yesterday, known white supremacist sympathizer, or maybe it was 2 days ago because it was on at night on Laura Ingraham's show, Stephen Miller, he went on her show to shocker, fearmonger about Afghan refugees coming into the United States, which is the least we can do after occupying that country for 20 years and causing lots of death. But of course, he's against it. And so CNN invited an Afghanistan veteran onto their program to respond. And I thought it was pretty interesting. I will say this is kind of something that outlets like CNN really love to do because they just really like the concept of military officials pushing back against Trump officials. It's some of the theme we saw throughout the Trump administration. But I thought this was pretty fascinating and good, actually. So let's take a look.
That we would take them to ours.
What do you say to that?
That man has been my personal nemesis now for almost 8 years. I've been fighting him since he was Jeff Sessions' Senate staffer. As far as I'm concerned, he personally is as complicit as the Taliban in these people's deaths. He should be held accountable for war crimes. He spent the entirety of the Trump administration purposely trying to prevent these people from coming here. I've had meetings with him and his ilk. I brought the interpreter who saved my life to some of those meetings. We met with a lady by the name of Andrea Loving. She's the deputy counsel for the House Judiciary Committee for the GOP. Janice and I were sitting in a meeting with her. She is Stephen's counterpart at the time in Congress. And we were debating about whether or not Congress should allocate more visas for these people. She then articulated what his platform was. I pointed to Janice and I said, you know, this is a gentleman who saved my life. Maybe you've just never had a chance to meet an Afghan. And so it helped to put a face to these people's names. And they looked at me and they said, you're doing nothing but letting Islamic fundamentalist terrorists into our country, and it's our job to stop you. Wrong. These are our people. There is no us and them. There's just an us. And you know what? Stephen Miller never wore a uniform a day in his life. He's a privileged little brat. He ought to be held for war crimes. I can't stand that man. I can't believe that you're even giving him any more airtime. That's the reason why that guy's views continue to get publicized, is because the media keeps putting him out there. That guy doesn't represent America. He represents the worst of us. What's going on right now, however, is the best of us. I'm currently involved with a massive airlift planning operation from my living room. There are veterans all over the country who are organizing a digital Dunkirk. We are not getting any sleep. We are determined to see our people get out, and we're not going to rest until we do it effectively and efficiently, and most importantly, until we take them all. But people like Stephen Miller need to just sit down and shut up, because he has been part of the problem for too long.
Matt, you...
So, I thought that was powerful and interesting in a variety of ways. Stephen Miller prosecuted for war crimes. I mean, that's, like, an interesting perspective.
I mean, let's not stop there, but, I mean, we should... there should be a definite war crimes tribunal for what happened there.
My point is that he's not on the first... Like, he's a white supremacist, but he's not the first on my list of people who need to be prosecuted for war crimes. There were a lot of people who had a lot more power, including George W. Bush, including Obama, who committed war crimes, including Trump, who committed war crimes, who might be a little bit higher on the list. Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, a variety of other actors and characters who should be on, although Don Rumsfeld maybe posthumously. But regardless, I did like what he said there, because, look, the way that people like Stephen Miller see their role in America is, of course, like preserving white hegemony. But they talk about Islamic extremists. They kind of see that as a parallel ideology for them, because they are white Christian fundamentalist extremists in this country. And so they characterize all Muslim people under that same banner in order to fuel their us versus them project, which hides their own extremism because it gets people to say, I'm on this team or whatever. The outrage there is justified, given, I would imagine, some difficulties with him that veteran there, Matt Zeller, grappling with why the hell we were even there and why he was even there.
Yeah, I mean, if we're going to limit our analysis to the withdrawal from Afghanistan and what the failure was at, and not get into like the occupation itself, but just the withdrawal, the failure is the lack of, you know, accommodation to get people out of there safely. And that is entirely because of a Stephen Miller and just his explicit, you know, objectives as a person in public life. But also the Democrats have been too afraid, and they've basically allowed him a veto, and they should stop being so afraid of letting refugees into this country.
Absolutely. I mean, before this, Biden was completely, I know he's updated his stance for Afghan refugees, but he was too afraid to let in more refugees because they fear of like this blowback from the Miller types and the Tucker Carlson types who are going to call you a sympathizer with the cause.
And they're also worried about the message you would send to other refugees from other parts of the globe. And this is part of like that deterrence thing where they say like, don't come here, right? Like this is
well, we you know, if we're going to say that all of the nations that have been touched by U.S. imperialism and our death squads and our military interventions, that they have a right to come here because of what we've done to their nations. Wow, that's a slippery slope. So yeah, that's exactly right. But unfortunately for our Peacock audience, we are out of time. And we will see you tomorrow on, which is a Friday. That is the day of the fry. Interesting end for me. I don't really.
That is a funny way to end.
Yeah, well, I hope you guys love it. This is what you're going to get for the next six shows. So we're going to head into the fun half shortly. Matt, though, I know Left Reckoning happened on Wednesday. You have some Patreon content, I imagine.
Yeah, we had a Harvey K on live last night. We talked about Afghanistan a little bit and also Biden's 200 days and why he basically all that FDR talk was a little bit premature and a bit silly. And then we also did about a half hour on Mark Levine, which was, I think, a bit of an odyssey. I've never done a big deep dive into Mark because he's very unpleasant to listen to compared to like Donald Trump or Rush Limbaugh.
Do your impression. That was pretty good.
Of Levin?
Yeah.
Oh, it's kind of like this. The Constitution and its Solinsky.
And then the postgame was very fun. Harvey stayed with us, and I got him to talk a little bit about Tom Paine and his rivalry with John Adams, who turns out was a bit of a Mark Levin of his time. And Tom Paine was sort of the Solinsky to John Adams back then. He thought Tom Paine's overly democratizing philosophy was everywhere, and didn't like that because he was a bit of an aristocrat desirer himself. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to get that post game with Harvey, and check out our Mark Levin. If you have, I'm also curious to hear from people in their life who have like Mark Levin, like uncles or dads. I feel like that's the main demographic who's watching this. And I want, like, that sucks. Because, like, I mean, I know people who listen to Limbaugh and stuff, but, like, Levin is just a different kind of abrasive and hysterical that I think, like, it must do something to your psyche for, like, at least a few hours after you listen to a show. So I'm anxious for people to comment on that. But patreon.com/leftreckoning.
All right. Left Reckoning. Check out Noma Key's show. Brandon's not here yet, but... there he is. And Matt can't join us. He is away this week, but check out Doomed. And of course, once Brandon joins us, he...
Yeah, I'll plug something else while Brandon is joining us here.
Yeah.
Tomorrow, we're recording for this weekend a conversation with Emma Kinema of the Communication Workers Association and of Gamers United. Game Workers United, I think. Talk about unionizing the video game industry and digital workplaces in general. So that'll be for patrons.
Nice.
And we'll release that for everybody afterwards.
Hey, Brandon.
Hey, Emma. Hey, Matt. How's it going?
Not bad.
What's happening over on the discourse?
Well, I'm just finishing up editing our latest episode. It should be out on the SoundCloud by end of today. So look forward to that. You know, we talk about rising COVID numbers. We talk about the America leaving Afghanistan, and a host of other things, including the 1998 edition of Charmed.
Wow. I do remember watching Charmed on sick days and over in the summers. That was like a fun show. But I don't know if I would have the wherewithal to talk about it on a podcast, Brandon.
I feel like maybe we should say this with Fun F. Yeah, let's go to Fun F. I want to ask you guys about sick days.
Oh, gotcha. What we did on sick days as kids?
And our generations of sick days, I think, was one of the best, maybe.
Oh, all right. 646-257-3920. See you in the Fun Half.
May have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabs.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.